is 3 o'clock. The place is Lansford's, PA. The date is June 11th, 1993. The interviewer is Lance Smets. The interviewee is George Harvin. I'm going to be asking you questions, George, about, first off, about your family background and about your early life. This is basically biographical material to build up a database. George, where were you born and when were you born?
I was born right next door on in Lansford, naturally, 1921, February 25th, 1921.
Which give me the exact street address next door?
It's 305 West Patterson. We're sitting at 307.
We're sitting at 307. Okay. What were your parents' names?
My mother's name was Anna. My father's name was Andrew.
What was her maiden name?
Sable. Anna Sable. Sable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When did you first become aware that you were living in a coal mining town?
Oh, at a very early age. I imagine I was, 7 or 8. My father was a coal miner. He was a coal miner for 40 years. So it was just a matter of watching him come home every day with his old dirty old clothes and things like that. So I was aware of it from the time I could, as far as I could remember.
Mm-hmm. Were you fascinated by the mines, or just took them as being a part of life?
Well, at first it didn't register at all to me. At that early age, it didn't register. The first indication I had, or association I had with coal mining, was when I was a youngster, sixth, seventh, eighth grade, and I had to fill up the coal bin next door. Mm-hmm. So it was just a matter of getting a wheelbarrow and getting some bags and going right up Shark Street here up to the top of the mountain in Sharp Mountain, where incidentally Lewis Ginter found the coal, but mm-hmm. he was further east up in Summit Hill. It was the same mountain, Sharp Mountain. There was outcrops of coal up along the top of the mountain. And we would go up there, and in the summertime, that was our job every summer. I had to fill the coal bin full of coal. And we would load the, most of the places, the coal was at the surface. But there was other times when we would run out of surface coal, we'd go have to dig a little hole, maybe 15, 20, 20 feet, and go down into the vein a little bit. We would crack the coal and things like everything else, size it and all that, and then put it in bags and haul it down, run down Sharp Street with a wheelbarrow, and dump it into the coal bin window.
Can you be a little bit more specific about how you mined the coal from the outcrop and how you cracked it and bagged it, what kind of equipment you used, and how long it would take you to do it?
Well, our two basic pieces of equipment were a pick and a screen, a hand screen. And where we came to the surface, the outcrop and all that, we found, everybody did it. Everybody filled their coal bin up. In fact, one of my best friends was Joe William, mm-hmm. Bill Bozo Krycerik. He was about 4 or 5, 6 years older than I was, and he was had a physique like Charles Atlas, much stronger and all that. And when it would come time to lift the coal out of the holes and all, out of the hole, he was willing to do it, because he was much stronger than I was. But, we would just get the coal out and screen it, get all the dirt out. Of course, then we would take all the slate or any rock or anything else was out of there, because God forbid you bring that home and they started to burn and get caught in the grate. You get your head knocked out.
Yeah,
you get your head knocked off. So it was that was mostly it. Just a pick and screening. A screen. It was a hand screen and screened all the dirt out of it. But it was a good time of the life. We usually picked coal till dinner time, lunchtime. Of course, then you were dirty by that time, good and dirty, with the perspiration and everything else. And then my mother would heat some water for me, on the kitchen stove. Every morning my father would build a fresh fire and let it go out during the day in the summertime. And she would heat the water for me and haul it down to the cellar into a wash tub, and that's where I took my bath. Mm-hmm. And that's how I, that was my early association with coal. I mean, that I really knew what was coal looked like, what it felt like, what it smelled like, and everything else.
Probably, you know, what it tasted like.
Tasted like, too, yeah. And that was my early association. But after we got the coal bin filled, we would sell the coal for 25 cents a bag, whatever was left over, you know, which was big money for us in those days. There weren't that many people willing to buy coal because no one had, it was depression time, that is, you're going back to the 30s, mid 30s, 35, 36, around 34, and not many people had money, and the people that could afford it and all that, or had somebody in the family, most families were fairly large. It was always three or four boys or something in it, and everybody filled a coal bin. I mean, just so that was the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm. Gonna switch topics slightly. You just gave me a very, very wonderful description of how you first became associated with coal.
Right.
How did you first become associated with cameras and photography?
I really don't know how it was. Well, my sister was a photographer, you know, and I she used to send pictures and all that home and things like that. And I don't know, it was something that I just wanted to do right from the beginning. I at a very early age, at this time in high school, and around high school, I picked up an old Jiffy Kodak. And it was fascinating to be able to develop the negatives up in the attic, you know, and make contact prints of the negatives. And it just seemed something I wanted to do right from the beginning.
What was your sister's name, full name again, for the record?
My sister was Rosa.
Rosa?
I thought.
Uh-huh. Just have to get these things for the record, George.
She became quite a famous photographer later on, which is another story.
Another story.
Mm-hmm. We could go on for hours of her exploits.
Well, someday we will. It'll be a separate interview, just mm-hmm. for the record. Jiffy Kodak, what size camera was that, and what type of film did you use?
It's the same size as the 120 Kodak now.
Okay.
The only was a 620, which is a smaller spool, and the film I don't think is available anymore.
Is it a bellows camera?
It was a camera that you pressed the button, it snapped out with a short mm-hmm. bellow, and it had a fixed focused, but I think the front element moved. You had to adjust the footage from 3 feet to infinity and all that.
What year would that be about, approximately?
Oh, I would say about 35, 30, 36, maybe 35, yeah.
What were some of your early subjects?
The one that I most remember vividly were the pictures I took of boxers uptown. Up the street was a little boxing club. Holmes's pool room, right in the back, they had a boxing club. And a good friend of mine, Joush McLaughlin, was a boxer. Of course, he didn't want his father to know about boxing and all that, so he went under the name of Wildcat O'Connor and Kid Joey and stuff, anything else, you know, to keep it. But when we'd come home, you know, his father would see his eyes bloodied, you know, blackened and everything else, he always had some type of excuse. But he was quite good. Later on, he got to be quite a good boxer. And associating with him and all that, I used to go up to the club and all that, and fool around with him and all that. And then I decided, you know, to take some pictures of him and all that. And I remember I still have some pictures someplace of him. It's little snapshots. But I remember they were one of the first pictures I remember developing and imprinting, and I was so thrilled at the time.
Where did you buy your developing and printing equipment from?
I don't remember.
Don't remember.
No, I don't remember that.
I was wondering if you bought it from mail order or if you bought it from a...
No, I probably got them up at Nesbitt's Cut Rate.
Okay.
Up at the corner of Cold Street there in Lansford, Colin Ridge, where they had a drugstore. Mm-hmm. They always had supplies because even after the war, I remember buying an enlarger from them. When I came back from the service, I remember buying an enlarger from them. There weren't many people taking pictures those days. First of all, like I said, money was scarce, and people, I guess, just didn't have the inclination to take pictures and all that. Not like nowadays, you know, everybody has a camera.
But not everybody knows how. Today, I think the big difference, I'm going to chime in here slightly, is that people today depend upon the camera to do all the work. And in those days, you wanted to take pictures. You not only had to do the work yourself to take the picture, but also you had to do the work to develop the picture, which gave you, I think, a better knowledge of the process.
Well, when you learn from scratch like that, you make an awful lot of mistakes, naturally, which I don't know if it's good or not. In the long run, you probably would have been better off if you had some instructions and all that, but what you pick up in books and all that, to this day, I've never gone to a photo school or a workshop in my life. Everything I've learned is more or less learned by instinct and from books and looking at other photographs. I learned a lot from looking at other photographs. And I haven't been able to do that until, you know, after I came out of the service, was able to see what a good print looked like in New York or something like that. You never know if your prints are any good or not because you never see. How do you compare? You have to compare with some other photograph.
You have to have a yardstick to measure by.
Right, exactly.
Were there any particular photographers, I'm jumping ahead slightly because you're talking about the post-World War II period, but were there any particular photographers who had an influence on you, if not inspiring your work, but giving you a yardstick to measure by?
Well, when I first started doing the mine photographs, this was all done by, like I said, more or less instinct and feel and what I learned in the service. I learned how to use a speed graphic and things like that. And so I was, when I came home from the service, I was able to utilize my knowledge of the speed graphic and but as far as the aesthetic aspect of the photographs, I really didn't have anything to go by, really. Later on, I became familiar with the works of Walker Evans and Eugene Smith and David Plowden, but they were all practically on the same level, and Adjaye, you know, the French photographer. But this was much later. In the 60s, and I started to be, I never knew who Walker Evans was or Eugene Smith until much later in, you know, my photographic. But I always had a curiosity about things that I think helped me more than studying with somebody. And I think in the long run, probably not being influenced by other photographers by an early age, you kind of develop your own style and all that. Some people might say it's dark and black and dark, you know, and things like that, or gloomy or things, but it's the way you do things and all that.
What you feel comfortable and comfortable with.
Yeah, the way you want to feel, you want the photograph to look, because you could, as you know, at many, you could, 10 photographers could take a negative and they'll come up with 10 different prints and it'll all look different.
Reality is somewhere in the eye of the beholder.
Right, yeah.
Well, let's back up a little bit with your photographic career. So you started out shooting your friends boxing.
Right.
What was your next major subject you started going into after that?
Well, and it was just the general scenes around the area here, you know, scenes from the mountain looking down over town and things like that. And course, by that time then, I graduated from high school, and there was no jobs around, so I joined a civilian conservation corps. That's the CCC. Mm-hmm. That was started by Franklin Roosevelt, and I spent 2 years there. I doubt whether I took a picture in a CCC, except snapshots to send home of your standing in the doorway of the barracks or something. And we only got $1 a day, and $22 of that every month went home, so you kept $8. So you didn't have much money for film or cameras or anything else, you know. And I can't remember really doing anything of any significance when I was in the CCs.
So we're looking at what, say 38, 39?
Well, I graduated in 38. I'm talking 39 and 40.
39, 40.
Mm-hmm, 40. Mm-hmm.
Where was the camp located? You were stationed
at? Well, the camp
at?
I was at Waynesboro. That's down on the borderline of
Pennsylvania, Maryland.
Parrots Lane, Maryland. Yeah, I was there for about a year, and then I became assistant leader. And then I became and I became a leader. And the last 6 months I spent in New Cumberland, outside of Harrisburg. And my job there was to take new rookies to different camps through the east and even out west and all that. And I remember, looking back, I remember taking boys down to Camp David now in Front Royal and Harper's Ferry and all that way, and all the way down into Tennessee. And and this was, I did that for 6 months, and then you were only allowed to stay for 2 years. But then by that time, Hitler, in 39, of course, Hitler became very evident, you know, and my boss in the CCs, Charlie Crane, who was my foreman, kind of took a fatherly feeling toward me and all that. So he always was warning me about this imminent war that was coming on. Of course, when you're, you know, 18 years old, you're 19, it's the furthest thing from your mind, you know. And he was right, you know, he was right. And then 39, then when I got out of the service, out of the CCs, I started to work at the Middletown Air Depot. I was there 6 months when, of course, then the war broke out. And
Middletown Air Depot, that was a parts place for airplanes?
No, that was that's an air depot outside of Harrisburg, down in Middletown. We repaired airplanes, and we did overhauled engines. And it was a kind of a repair garage for airplanes, you know, like a car thing. Everything was done through an airplane, electrical systems. Of course, there weren't that many planes and all that, and we did all that work. And I was just starting to work there. I was only there 6 months, really, when the war broke out.
Was this a government facility?
Government?
Was it private or government?
Oh, no, this was a government facility, sure.
Government facility?
Government. Oh, sure. They had air depots all through the east. Middletown, one up at Westover Field in Massachusetts. One down near Washington, I think, you know. And they had one out in California, out at San Bernardino, I know that. And they also had the one out at Hickam Field, which, when the war broke out, it was December the 8th, they asked for volunteers to go to Hawaii, because as you know, all the planes were shot up and the ships and all that. We really didn't have anything, and there was a captain there. Now, I was on a night shift at the time, and there was a captain stood in the steps, and we all congregated him around, you know, around the circle and all that. He explained the situation, and we needed a lot of there was a lot of work to be done out in Hickam Field. So, of course, I volunteered to go out, not knowing that they weren't going to take me because I only had 6 months' experience, and I thought they would take a lot of other more knowledgeable people. But right after Christmas, I got the word to be to go, and that's where I wound up. And I was on the first convoy that left San Francisco after the war. We had shifted six ships. I was on a U.S. Grant. He had just come down from Alaska with dependents. It was all full of everything. The people had a rough voyage, and it was really pukey on the thing.
Oh, God.
And there was one troop ship, the USS Grant. We had two destroyers, and we had two freighters. The two freighters contained crates of airplanes, the B-26 Martin Marauder bomber.
Oh, wow.
And that was our job. We went over there to put these things together.
Have you ever seen a B-26 before?
No, but I flew in them.
Was it hard putting together that complex an airplane? Or did you have instruction manuals, or how did you do it?
Well, it was, we had the people from the factory, from the Martin plant, you know, from Baltimore, come over and more or less supervise the putting together. But we had to check them out then, you know, after we put the things together. And it was a hot ship, you know. It wasn't, I don't think they truly tested it properly, but I think they were thrown into the breach, you know, more or less, because they had nothing else, really.
Well, some of the planes you put together were fought at Midway.
Oh, yes, we lost all of them at Midway then, because we had outfitted them with torpedo racks. And I was scheduled to go to Midway, too, right during the battle, but right at the last minute when the battle turned and all that, they didn't need us there anymore. And then, of course, we lost all the planes. But we lost quite a few B-26s, even in flight and all that. In fact, one of my best friends was killed right over the channel. He just took off, and it was his turn to check out the plane, and he was killed.
Yeah, that was the problem with them. The wings were too short.
They had the old Davis wing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't a plane that was really tested properly. And yeah.
They call it the Widowmaker.
The Widowmaker.
Yeah.
Exactly. Either that or whatever.
Yeah, they never quite got that. They got perfected by the end of the war, but they never used them in the Pacific much after 1941 because they didn't have the range, but they took them over to Europe, and they finally got them shook out over in Europe. They had to add more to the wing. Wing was too short.
Right, yeah. Well, then they came out with the B-25, which was the Mitchell bomber then, which was much more dependable. But this was like a cigar. We used to call it the flying cigar.
So how long were you in Hawaii then? Maybe about 4 months?
Well, I was too young for the draft when I got there. Because I got there in January. My birthday was in February. And I was old enough for the draft. Of course, then I was drafted. I was drafted in Hawaii and took my basic training with all the island boys and all that. And then, of course, being as I was sent over to work on these planes, I was put into reserves and sent back down there to Hickam. I was there for a couple of years, and then I went into the service from there.
So what year did you go into the service? About 1943?
Right, yeah, 43.
What rank did you go in as, since you already had some reserve time and everything?
Well, I just went in as a private.
As a private?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in a private, and then went down to Hickam Field for a while, and was working on planes and all that, and it was a long story and all that. I got to... planes got the best of me. So I was in, after being in the hospital for about 2 months, the psychologist and all that, people going through there asked me what I'd like to do, and I said, well, I like to take pictures. And that's how I got into the photography field in the service, and I transferred then from the 7th Air Force to the 5th Air Force, and I wound up in Japan, and the camera took me to a lot of places.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. How did they train you to be an Air Force photographer, an Army Air Force photographer?
Never had any training.
Never had any training?
Never. I told you, I never went to school or anything.
Right, you did your early art.
Never had any training. I went in, and it was just this feeling I think I had for a camera that no matter what time I, every time I picked up the camera or something, I was able to use it, you know.
How did it feel to have a nice piece of camera equipment like a Speedgraphic in your hands for the first time?
Oh, well, that was like heaven, because I was able, especially when I got to Japan, you know, and it was right after the armistice was signed, we moved into a place called Hiramagawa. It was the base that the kamikaze pilots trained. Ooh. And it was a very Spartan base. I mean, it was just a plain barracks, you know, and at night the rats ran up and down the ceiling, you know, the false ceiling and all that, and you looked up, you'd see all these splotches and all that, and it was a, but that's where I was stationed, and we had a little photo lab there, and after a while I became head of the photo lab there, and I was able, I always had a Jeep, I had, of course, I had the insignias on my uniform and all that I was a photographer for the Air Force, and I was able to get to an awful lot of places that ordinarily, the ordinary GI couldn't get into, you know. On some Sundays I had nothing to do or something, I'd get in the Jeep and go up into the mountains, and you could see that the people never even saw a GI before, and there were all these stories had been spread that in time, you know, the Americans would rape the children and the women and things like that, and I would park the Jeep and walk down these dirt streets, and I could see the women, the people scurrying off the streets into their house, and I could see the curtains being pulled, you know. I look back now, and I thought I took an awful chance doing a lot of these things, but I don't know, you get kind of, there's something about a camera. You put a camera in your hand, and you have no fear. I mean, no matter what it is, it's the same thing when you go down the mines or in an airplane or you're taking accident pictures or you're standing alongside or you're on the football field on the sidelines and all these players bearing down at you. And you, there's something about a camera, you seem to lose, I don't know if it's because you're so absorbed in what you're doing, you forget about fear, whatever it is, but when I had that Speedgraphic in my hand, it was kind of like a weapon, I guess.
The sort of block between you and the rest of the world.
Right, yeah. Uh-huh. And
so you not only shot your own pictures, but you also did all your own printing and developing?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, when I became head of the lab in Japan, of course, I had people working for me and all that. We did everything. One of my biggest... one of the most things I remember mostly was I was one of the few people other than the royal family who ever got into the Imperial Palace in Japan.
You were in the Imperial Palace?
I was in.
What was it like?
Well, after being out in the Pacific like for 4 years and all that, and I see all this splendor and all that, and then you walked off the streets of Tokyo and right around the Imperial Palace was devastation, buildings down, people, you know, scurrying about in rubble, trying to find things and everything else, and putting bricks, you know, together and everything else, and then all of a sudden you walk into the Imperial Palace and our bombers never touched it, you know, we never touched it at all.
That was on purpose.
I know it was, yeah. I kind of felt, you know, I always thought that we were going to need the emperor after this was all over with and all that, and in order to keep all this intact, some sort of stability into the country and all that, I think that they more or less say, let's keep our hands off the emperor, because I guess they felt, you know, he was just a figurehead. He wasn't,
yeah,
he went along with it naturally, but you know. The reason why I got into it is Prince Akihito was 10 years old at the time, and they were throwing him a birthday party.
Oh, my God.
Now he's the emperor now. Mm-hmm. In fact, his son just got
married.
And the commanding officer of the base was invited. He was a general. I think it's Burns, I'm pretty sure. It's been a while. And he was invited to it, and of course he wanted pictures. And I told him, I can't take pictures inside, I have no flash bulbs at the time. He said, I'll get your flash bulbs. A few days later, Jeep comes, truck comes up with box crates of big flash bulbs, you know, and film packs, which was great. So we set off, and we got into that, into the palace, and I don't have any negatives. I had to leave them all behind and all that, but it was quite an experience.
So somewhere in the National Archives system are your...
I don't know where the negatives are. The only negatives I have really of Japan were my personal negatives that I took my, roller cord. I have no 4 or 5 negatives at all.
But they must exist. This gives me some curiosity, because it must exist somewhere in the Library of Congress system. I'm going to have to do some checking for that. So how long were you in Japan altogether?
Almost 2 years.
Would you concentrate, like with your later emphasis, you concentrated so much on people. Mm-hmm. You said to me that one of your primary things, your photographic philosophy evolved with shooting people. Uh-huh. Were you as interested in shooting people over there?
It's amazing. When I look at my pictures of Japan now, it could be the coal mines. It's the same type of I was interested in buildings and things like that. I was interested in people in the streets of Tokyo, the people who were the beggars, the little boys, the homeless boys and things like that, or the women pushing these big carts through the streets, you know, with all their belongings on a cart. And I was interested in that, and I still have a wonderful collection of Japanese pictures. I would say maybe 300-400 of the streets of Tokyo.
That's a real treasure, because so few people thought about it. They just thought it as being a mass of ruins, you know, and you saw life.
Well, I got the people going through the ruins, you know, rummaging through the buildings and things like that, but it's mostly the people trying to eke out a living, selling different things on the street, you know, whatever they can, combs or whatever, you know, anything, and pencils, and there were very little activity on the streets. Every now and then you'd see a truck that was powered by soft coal or something like that, you know, it's trudging down the street. Most people pushed everything by cart, you know, by hand. Some of the loads were so huge, I mean, you wonder how they ever could move them, you know.
Was Japan your last assignment in the service?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you came home to get discharged, basically.
Yeah, and I almost did make it. Right before I was discharged, maybe about 3 or 4 months, there was an awful train wreck I'd say about a half an hour from my base, and I hopped in. I heard about it through the radio service, the Armed Forces radio service, and I heard about this train wreck and all that, so I got permission to go over and see what it was all about. So I went over there, and there was a train wreck. The train was coming down a grade, a fairly steep grade. There was a turn at the bottom of it, and all the cars at the time were made out of wood, except the undercarriage, which was steel, and the wheels and all that. And they get down near the bottom, this thing overturned on top of them, just landed on all these people.
Oh,
and all God. There was 156 killed. And they had all these people out in the... When I got there, they were just taking them out and putting them on the field, you know, and stretching them out and to identify them and all that. And then the survivors or relatives or something like that would come with carts and wheelbarrows and everything, anything else, and would put them on the thing, cover them up, and trudge off with them. Well, I had shot with the 4x5 speed gather guy, I had shot a number of negatives, and I took him into Tokyo. There was a fellow by the name of Russell Brines, who was head of the AP Bureau at the time, and of course he liked the photographs then, and he paid me for them and this and that. And when I would get into Tokyo after that, he would we would talk, have lunch and all that, and then he offered me a job as an AP photographer in Tokyo. And I had been out there so long, it was like over five years, you know, and
trying
I
to go home.
It was time to go home. So put in for a discharge, you know, and I went to a place called Zama, which was kind of a replacement center. And One group pulled out. I was still sitting there. Another group pulled out. I'm still sitting there. I thought, oh, they lost my records. So I went up to the headquarters and I wanted to know why I wasn't getting on one of these boats, you know. So sergeant looked up my records. He said, well, we're waiting to send you home. I said, well, that's where I want to go. He said, yeah, but your home is in Hawaii. He said, that's where you were drafted.
Oh.
And I said, no. I said, I live in Pennsylvania. He said, no, I'm sorry. He said, but you got to go to Hawaii. He said, we got to send you back to where you're drafted. So I said, no. So there was a captain sitting there listening to all this, and I was getting a little impatient with this guy, you know. And so he asked me I told him the whole story, how I got there, and this and what went transpired through the years and all that. And he said, I'll see what I could do. And about a week later, he got me to California. He said, that's the furthest I could get you. So I was discharged at Camp Stoneman.
Where in California was that?
That's near San Francisco, almost where I took off from.
The beginning?
In the beginning, yeah, right outside of San Francisco.
Full circle.
Mm-hmm.
So how'd you get home back here to Pennsylvania?
Well, when I was in Japan, I told you I never had any instructions and all that, and someone had sent me a magazine, a photography magazine. I picked it up. I was reading about the Art Center School in Los Angeles. And I thought, gee, that would be great if I could get some good instruction, you know. So I applied, sent some of my Japanese pictures and all that. I sent them to the Art Center School, told them when I was getting out of the service, and if I could, I applied for admission to the Art Center School. So when I got to Camp Stoneman, I thought I'll go to Los Angeles and see what the school looked like. So I went down from San Francisco down to Los Angeles and saw the school, met the people there, and we talked, and they said, yeah, they'll be able to take me in September. I thought, good, this was June. So I thought, well, I'll go home for a few months and spend some time at home, then go back out in September. And right before Labor Day, I got a note saying that they were filled up and they can't take me until January. So then I didn't much feel like sitting around till January, so I started work for the morning call.
Okay.
So that's where I started.
So to work for the morning call. Were you worked out of their main office in Allentown?
No, there was an office right up here in Center Street.
Okay.
Just about a block from here. It was a branch office. We had Bill Tiley headed it at the time. And then we had Bernie Butler and Eddie Lapis and Rudy Bednar and a few girls and all that, and Joe Flasney. And I worked out of there for a while. I'm
gone.
Sorry. And then there was an air crash up near Mount Carmel with Jack Oakey's wife was killed. There were, I think there was 56 killed or something like that.
Commercial plane
was going from Hollywood, from Los Angeles to New York, and hit into that mountain right above between Centralia and Mount Carmel. Hit into that mountain, and of course everybody was killed and all that. It was a day off, and I went in the car and took pictures and all that, and then they saw these in Allentown and all that, and then they offered me a job in Allentown, and I worked in Allentown after that.
What kind of equipment did you start working with when you worked for the call? Start using?
Oh, they use a Speed Graphic too.
Same sort of using in the service.
Yeah, that's when I started here at the call. That's why they had to train people, but when I went in, I loaded the holders and picked up the camera and went out. The first day I went out and did an assignment, which was different for them because they didn't have to train anybody, so that was great for them, you know, because I was familiar with the camera.
Remember what your first assignment was?
Not really. No. But I remember loading the holders and picking the camera up and going out and shooting the thing, coming back and developing the negatives. But I was familiar with the camera, you know. No, we used a 3 1/4, 4 1/4 speed graphic in Allentown. And Frank Marsteller was the head of the lab at the time, at the department at the time. And we had Milton Rockmaker, who passed away, John Nicholas from Catasauqua, and a fellow named Denenberger. He was from Bethlehem. He went with Moravian after Moravian College after that. And we used a 3 1/4, 4 1/4 speed graphic. One day I went out, was assigned to a school, it was a series of pictures of a school in, I think it was the Robb School in Allentown.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh great, I had borrowed a 35 millimeter camera from my sister, a Leica, an old Leica. Now this would be great for candid shots, you know. So I put a roll of film, 35 millimeter, and shot these candid shots, and came back with them, printed them up, and we had an old editor, old Ned McGettigan, who was in his 80s. He was quite a character, and he used to wear his glasses down over his nose, you know, and his close-up reading glasses, you know, and he looked at the pictures, and he looked at me, and he looked at the pictures, and he kept, his head kept going up to the pictures and down. And then Frank walked in, and he said, Frank, he said, why the hell can't we always get pictures like this, you know, real picture, candid, no flash, you know. And, oh, Frank kind of turned red and everything else, you know, didn't know what to say. And after it was all over, I felt pretty good, you know. I thought, oh, God, he liked them and everything else. Then Frank stopped me. He said, don't you ever do that again. He said, we take pictures with 3 1/4, 4 1/4, and nothing else. And the camera, the light goes at 45 degrees, and that's it. So that was the end of my relationship with Frank.
So that was your first really professional use of a 35?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. I just thought it was would be the ideal. The place was well lit. The school, was well lit and all that. It was well. I knew I didn't need the flash, and I thought, well, why not use something that it had an old 50 millimeter Sumar, the old lens. So it was a matter of snapping these kids and.
Well, then it goes back. You know, I'm going to play advocate here again if I can. It goes back to your idea of being people oriented. You know, with a 35, you could catch people in motion and people in being themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
With a 4x5, it's rather intimidating, and you have to take your time and set it up.
Yeah, in a way it is. Yeah. Of course, the ease of using a 35 too is, I mean, you can just put it to your eye and you're able to catch moments that you would miss with a 4x5. The 4x5 was great, but you know. As you know yourself, it lost out to the 2 1/4 rolly type thing, and then the rolly lost out to the 35. Now everybody can actually use 35. Newspaper, magazines, and all that. Unless you're looking for extreme detail or stuff, but it's for the candid type pictures, you don't need it. If you're looking for the people, if you're looking. When I first started in the mines, I did all my work with 4x5s, you know, because I didn't have the way to light 35 millimeters, and lighting was a problem in the mines.
Mm-hmm. Let's backtrack a little bit and finish up what we can with the call. Is there any assignments that you have that really stand out in your mind when you work for the call?
Well, of course, the air crash.
Air crash.
Mm-hmm.
With Jack Oakley's wife.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
I don't know if I was working for the call then, or if I had left the call and I was working, doing some freelance work for the Lancer Record, but I remember photographing Truman in Pottsville and all that, which was kind of, I was a little late getting into Pottsville and all that, and by the time I got my car parked and all, I was way up at the end of the train, and I started walking down alongside the train, and all of a sudden this door opened up halfway down, and Secret Service agents come out, and Truman stood right up the first step. He was coming out, and I just blurted out, "Can I have your picture, Mr. President?" And he said, "Sure." I took two shots, and that was it.
Beautiful. We can talk about serendipity. This would have been about, what, 48 election?
I would say, yeah, it was after, yeah. I don't know the year, but it was a funny thing. After I walked down with them all the way down to the stands where he gave his talk, you know, and all that. And of course, I was one of the boys by then. I walked all over the platform. I thought nowadays you wouldn't get
30 feet of it.
Oh goodness! I walked all along the whole platform, any place I wanted to go. I had no one stay there and say anything.
That's sort of a sad commentary about America, how much we've lost, how we've encapsulated these figures so much. Encapsulated isn't the wrong word. Insulated is the word.
Yeah, because I remember, I have a picture I took of John Kennedy up in Hazelton. And when I was ready to take his picture and all that, I don't know if there was a loud noise or something like that in the background or something like that, and he's standing there with his hands clutched close to his chest, you know, and all the other secret agents and everything else are all looking off to the side. It almost was like a prelude of what was going to happen.
To him,
it was
one of
my photographs I'm really proud of, because it shows the tension in the air and as if something's about to happen.
About how long did you work for the call, and why did you decide to leave?
Oh, I think I worked for the call for about 2 years. Might have been a little longer, I'm not sure. I left because when I left Lansford to go to Allentown, they promised me the starting salary in Allentown. And when I got to Allentown, they wanted to start me off as a new man, as if I hadn't worked for the call at all. And I had worked for about a year for that, you know, before that. So they wanted to start me off as a new person, new employee. And the union heard about it, and they thought that it wasn't fair, and they were going to take the case up. The union was just starting. The guild was just starting at the time. But I was kind of getting tired of the work I was doing there. I was taking parties and this and that, and everything. A lot of installation of offices at different clubs and things like that. And I wasn't real happy doing the work. So I figured the first opportunity I would get, I would leave. Well, they didn't want me to leave, so I said, well, I can't stay in Allentown but I couldn't afford it. So they said, well, why don't you go back to Lansford? I said, all right. So I'm back to Lansford, and I stayed in Lansford for maybe about 6 months after that. And then what turned me off really was we had a sit-down strike up at number 6, and the men were in the mine, I guess, in number 6. I guess they were there about for 5 or 6 days. And the company people wanted them, the miners, to get out of there, you know. And they kind of agreed just one day to come out. So Freddie Gallagher, who was the union, head of the union at number 6, stopped at the office, and he said to Eddie Lapis, he said, "Ed, the men are coming out tomorrow morning." He said, "Get a photographer, go up." He said, "You can get a good story and get some pictures." So of course we get up early in the morning, get up to number 6 and go up to the gate and stopped. We were stopped at the gate by a policeman, and he said, "Where are you fellas going?" He said, "Well, we heard the miners are coming out today." And he said, "Who told you that?" And he said, "Well, we got a good authority that they were coming out." And he said, "You can't go in." So Freddie and Johnny Robin, who was a union man, they saw us at the gate, and they came down, and he said, "What's wrong, Ed?" And they said, "Well, they won't let us in." And Freddie Gallagher told the fella, He said, well, if they don't go in, he said, the miners are staying down the mine. They're not coming out. So then he said, well, I'll have to talk to Mr. Price, who was the superintendent. So he called Tom Price down, and they huddled together, and they said, okay, you could go up. They let us in. The miners come on. That one picture I showed you before, that was miners getting ready. I had other good shots of them having their first cigarette and things like that, and hugging each other, the mine, the union men. And we felt good about it. He felt that it had a good story, and I had some good pictures and all that. And I get down to the Lansford office, and I was developing my negatives and all that, and all of a sudden, Bill Tiley come flying through the door, and he said, where you fellas been? We told him up there. And of course, the company had alerted him that we were up there. He knew where we were. He said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm typing. He was off the teletype. He was sending a story down. He said, stop what you're doing and send a paragraph down. Tell them the miners out of the number 6 colliery. They've stopped their strike and all that, and they're all in good shape, and they're in good condition and everything else, and that's it. One paragraph, and that's it. So he said, where's your negatives? I said, well, they're hanging up in the dark room. And he got all the negatives and flopped them all together and took them. And that was the only thing in my haste to develop the negatives. I left one holder in the camera. And that's the one shot there and that I was able to save. And later on, I developed it. I had two negatives of the thing, and that was. But that kind of turned us all off. Bernie Butler left after a few months. Eddie left after that, and then I left, and that was it. It was. We were being muzzled a little bit, you know, and you know, in a company town, and I imagine it happens all company towns where
long arm of the company.
Yeah, and. They knew what they were doing. He said, well, let them in. Take the pictures. He said, well, nothing's going to happen anyway.
We'll cut it off downstream. Do you remember what was the cause of the strike?
I don't remember. I could probably find that out in the archives.
I'm just curious because, it seemed like a very dramatic situation. Okay, so you left the call. Then where did you go to?
Then I started my own little business, taking weddings and things like that. By that time I got married, you know, so I had to do something. And then Ted Berger approached me about doing some freelance work for the coal company. Ted was the PR man for Lewis and Gilman, who handled the coal company account. And they had the office in Philadelphia. And Ted was a representative up here. Ted was a former Call Chronicle man, too. And, of course, he needed pictures every now and then. And he knew me, I guess, from the call and all that. Wanted to know if I would do some work. And I agreed. And he would always say, well, we would go down the mines. We'd need so-and-so shots and things like that, you know, like whatever, you know, in the shots and filling in the breast or something. And, of course, he would always agree to go down with me, but the night before he'd call up, he'd say, you know what I want. He said, you go down and get what we need. And so when I went down, it was usually down in Coaldale, down number 8, and I would get the shots, but then I would figure, as long as I'm here, I'm going to take others. You know, there's no one around. They never knew what I was, pictures I needed or something like that. And at that time, very few people were allowed in mines to take pictures because of safety problems. They didn't want to know what was going on in there and things like that. And the danger, you know, they didn't want anybody getting hurt.
So the backtrack, this would be around 52, 53?
Oh, no, I'd say 49.
I have to set chronology here.
No, about 49, yeah.
About 49. Did you feel when you, and coming from a coal mining family, you were living in Lansford, you already had an experience with the mines, but did you feel a natural affinity for the miners when you first started doing this?
Oh yeah. I think the first, after a few times, you know, and I printed them up, printed the negatives up, and I made some 11, 14s, I kind of thought I was onto something right there, right from the beginning. Yeah, and that's why I not only took what I was supposed to take,
right.
I took other things too. I thought, well, that looks great, I took that, and then I stayed. If I just took what they wanted to, I would have been in and out of there maybe in a couple hours or something like that, but sometimes I would stay for the whole shift. And I had a little, Johnny Houghton was one of the fire bosses. He was a little fella, but he could really skirt around the mines. You know, he could go up and down those breasts, up in those chutes and all that. And I got to know Johnny pretty good, and any place I wanted to go, he stayed with me all day practically, whatever I wanted to do. And carried some equipment for me if I wanted to, my lights or something. And he was a fire boss, but he would, whenever I had to take pictures, he would accompany me more, you know, through the mines.
So he took an interest in your work. It was more than just a job, and he really took a sincere interest in your work then.
Oh.
Johnny did.
No. Johnny didn't. No, he was just, he was just doing a job. That was his job, to accompany, you know, accompany the thing.
Oh, I see. He's your escort, more or less.
Right, yeah, sure. Yeah, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was, just somebody who knew the mines, I could ask questions about, and I could find out what this miner was doing and things like that. And then I would tell him, you know, where the good areas, where to go with breasts, where to go into, and things like that. And the thing was startling. I mean, you go into a cavern, you know, you're down 1,000 feet underground or so, and then you walk into this room like with nothing but coal, you know, and it was fantastic, you know. And then you had to figure out, how can I photograph this? How can I make, you know, bring this to life? Because everything's, like I said, the only light you had up there was the light on your hat, you know. And same thing, the miners were working, that's all. You saw these two lights bobbing around out there in front of you, you know.
So you were fascinated by a technical problem because you had to overcome it. You had no trepidation at all about being in the mine. You didn't feel any fear or anything. You just were concerned about technical problems of how they do your work.
I thought about it a lot of times too, especially when I would be trying to keep up with Johnny going up, you know, up 35 feet or something, up into a chute or something, and I'd be panting, and I'd lay there with his cameras, and I were, what in the world am I doing here, you know? But once I got up into the breast and all that, and I was able to get my bearings and all that, I would be all right. And I had to solve the technical problem, because if I didn't, I wouldn't get pictures. I wouldn't have got paid, you see. And all the annual reports and things like that, and requests for pictures they might have had, or like the long roll drills and stuff like, you know, it was, somebody was making, the manufacturers wanted pictures and things like that. So, but I always managed to take a few extra pictures.
That's what caught your eye, more or less.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned before, very few people were allowed to take pictures, and I was kind of thought, well, gee, I was kind of privileged and all that to be allowed to take pictures down in the mines. And it started from there that I started to build up a little library of photographs and, you know, negatives and all that. And it was just, it wasn't that it was something I was doing every day or every week. It might happen a month, maybe I'd go for 2 or 3 months and I'd get another assignment or something like that. And maybe it'd be 6 months or something before I'd get another one, you see. But through the years, I was able to build up a series of negatives, you know, that I don't have that many, really, but...
The quality is superlative.
It's something now, it's hard to explain to somebody what a breast looks like and the vein of coal, and it's hard to explain to somebody, you know, the conditions and the dirt and everything else and the feel these miners have on. So I had a show down in Lehigh. It was just a small show, that a branch off of the the big show I had down at Lehigh, and it was during the alumni weekend at Lehigh, and it was in the Ralph Wilson Gallery. It must have been just consisted of about 18 or 20 photographs. And I had got down, it was a Saturday morning, and I was off to the side when this elderly couple approached me, and someone had pointed out that I took the pictures, and we got to talking about the pictures and all that, and how impressed they were and all that. It was an elderly couple from Brooklyn, and they told me that they never realized what a coal mine really looked like inside. And they said that they never were really a great fan of John L. Lewis, you know. But they said after looking at these photographs and all that, though, maybe some of the things he did was justified, you know, is when he asked for better working conditions for the miners and more safety, you know, a little more safe conditions and all that. And he said maybe he was justified in what he was after, you know. And it was kind of a compliment because people could see this in these photographs, and without now to explain to this couple, it would have been hard with words, I think. And
the image has so much more power.
Yeah. And that was one indication there. I thought that, well, I must be getting something across, you know, because here's a strange couple who I knew nothing about was able to get something from these photographs. And it was only a small show, so it was only about 18 or 20 photographs.
When you weren't in the mine shooting the miners, what other sorts of assignments would Ted Berger have you do?
Oh, besides going in the mine?
Yes.
Oh, there was always dealer groups going into the mines, you know, and of course every dealer group had to have their picture taken, you know, and we did that at the number 8 mine. Of course they had the clothes there,
right.
They wore the miners' hats and the pamphlets and everything else. So we always had that to do, and that was every month or so, you know. That was there were always groups going in. There was always dealer groups coming from all over.
Were these guys pretty good guys, or sometimes were they pains in the butt?
The dealers?
Yeah.
Oh no, they were interesting people. Some of them are real interesting, yeah. The coal company was like the steel company in its heyday too. They threw money all over the place, you know, and they had trips going to Bermuda for dealers and stuff like that, you know, which I went on, you know. And they would hire a plane and put 40 dealers on it, and then hire a hotel in Bermuda and then entertain them for 3 or 4 days, you know, and then bring them back and off to the PR. You know, they were selling coal if they were going to treat you right, you know. But I did other things too. They had Split Rock Lodge. They had a lot of meetings up there, technical meetings and meetings with bosses and things like that. There was other things I did, yeah.
How did you feel as the 50s wore on and you saw the mines start to hit the climatic years of like 54, 55, when things were starting to really, really get tight? Could you sense it, you know, during the period, or was it just something that came about rather suddenly?
To me, it was sudden, yeah. It was very sudden. I always thought there'd be mines here, but then I always thought that way about the steel, which is that way too. And steel's still there, but it's, you know, just
a shadow.
Yeah, it's just a I never thought that the coal, this first inkling you would read in the papers or something like that, you know, that, you know, if they, the miners don't sign this contract or something like that, they'll have to close the mine. But after a few of these false reports and all that, you thought nothing of it and all that. So one day they just closed it and that was it, you know, and I never thought that they would close. I always thought, God, there'll be mines here to, when, you know, up until that time I died.
Did you record much, George, in your work of the closing process during this period?
Oh, yeah. I would, Every time there was a closing, and there was a number of closings, they would close and then it would open up, then June and Julian opened up, you know, and I'd go down with the 35, and I would take pictures in the wash handy and getting into the cars with their clothes and things like that, and pondering what to do with their old equipment, their drills and things like that.
You also photographed some. Did you photograph some of the mass meetings and things like that?
Oh yeah, in Tamaqua, yeah, with Casey Gilday. Remember Casey had some, and oh yeah, and then down at the park here we had some. I remember, I never have any photographs, but I remember during the, I don't know when the NRA stand, the National Recovery Act, was that before the war or after?
It's before the war.
Before the war. I remember huge rallies for that, but I don't have any pictures of that. But I remember huge rallies of it, which would have been great if I could have.
Okay, so the mines are down. What happened then? Did Berger lose his contract, or did they still keep on going?
Yeah. Ted lost the account. Of course, there was no account anymore. Of course, I lost my account.
You know. With Ted?
Yeah, and that's, I was practically living off that. You know, that's probably the only account I had, which I was making enough because, you know, the prices that an agency in Philadelphia was paying was something that I couldn't even dream of, Gav. And I was doing freelance work too then, too.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing work for different magazines, Pop Photo, I would sell stories to, Saturday Evening Post a few stories, you know, and pictures, and, you know, I'd get $500 here and $700 here, which was great. But that's, I lost the account, yeah. And then, I applied to Steel. Mm-hmm, that's when I applied to Steel and I lost the account, yeah. Of course, then the fellow started up the Lance Coal and all that, but I was working at the Steel at the time, and any chance I got, though, vacation days or anything else, I would go down. And that's how I started the Lance Coal pictures.
Now, I'm going to ask you about that if I can. Lance Coal really, I think, is some of your best work, if not your best work. From my own personal perspective, you can really see it was a labor of love.
Yeah.
Did you approach them or they approach you to start it?
Oh, I think I approached them. Oh no, I approached them. I know I did. By that time I felt I had just had to photograph. I knew then that this was coming to an end, and I was getting kind of desperate. You know, that I was afraid it would close before I really get any pictures at all. And any opportunity, if I had a week's vacation, I'd just spend a week down there. Take my whole vacation and go down there and shoot pictures, and some days it would work out great, other days I would just go down and have a lot of fun with the fellas, you know, but I got to know them pretty well, and I think that shows in the photographs now, because most of the men I took when I was taking for the company, I knew them, but I wasn't kind of, I didn't know them personally,
right.
You know.
It wasn't like it was a job more than a personal relationship.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is a labor of love. Lance Coal is a labor of love.
Yeah, and they made an impression on me, you know, and I felt that, I just felt that there was something there that I had to photograph. And like I said, it became desperate after a while, you know. I was afraid, hey, this is going to close before we get any pictures of this, you know, and then it's all going to be gone, but it was a good thing for me too. In other words, being as I knew them, I was able to go down any time and walk into the gangway, you know, walk into the water tunnel and walk into their workings, which took me maybe 20 minutes or something like that, or 25 minutes, but I was able to walk in any time, and I didn't have to wait for a special invitation or inquire.
Or an escort or something.
Or an escort, so I could go in any time. And then I would usually listen to where they were firing, and I knew where they were working and all that, you know.
That must have been quite a change from your full-time work at the Steel, because Steel, I imagine, it was very structured what they asked you to do, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was so regulated, you know. And everything had to be well lit, overlit a lot of places, which mm-hmm. happened to a lot of mine photographs by some photographers. I noticed a lot of mine photographs that I have seen were just overly lit, you know. Mm-hmm. They lit them up like an overlit parlor or something like that. And the book you gave me in that Sowicklin, mm-hmm. the man from Jeddo, miner from Jeddo. The subject matter is great and all that, but I noticed there that they start stringing lights all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it was the same thing with the steel. If they wanted to show a certain type of equipment hauling coal out, you know, one of those big conveyor things and all that, they wanted that thing lit from beginning to the end, you know, and maybe with 10 flash bulbs or something like that, you know. And it showed the machinery and everything, but it didn't show the atmosphere.
The relationship between the man and the machine, which is, mm-hmm. I think, so important. It's a side light. When you work for the steel, did you ever get down to the bituminous mine?
No.
Never got out there?
Mm-hmm. Never did. I was promised to go out there a number of times, but I had approached them once about going out with the 35 and just taking the people who worked in the mine, but they never went for that. Which I also wanted to do in the steel. I thought it'd be great going there with the 35 and just capture all these steel workers, you know. But they don't. They were regulated like the coal companies at the time.
They still are.
As you mentioned, they are. They are. They didn't want anybody roaming around there. That you took your picture, and that's it. Finish. Go on home.
You know, I've snuck better stuff out of the steel than I've taken through their system, because a couple of times Joe and I were snuck in at night, you know, when the security guards weren't there. Well, that's even changing now because...
Okay, George, we're talking about Lance Coal, and you sensed that it was something very, very special, mm-hmm. and was different than Bethlehem Steel. How did you feel? You talked earlier about you felt that something you had to do, the time was limited, that the time was running out. How did you feel towards the end of Lance Coal when you knew the time actually was going to run out? Did it change your perceptive or the way you shot? Or
not really. It didn't change the way I shot and all that. But of course, when it did happen, it was a very, very sad day. Naturally, and I just felt like it was hard to believe that you would not be able to go into this mine again and take pictures and all that. And I didn't change anything as far as the way I took pictures. No, I was always looking for something different to take, naturally, you know, and trying to get a little more of the activity, not mining activity in the mine, but things that happen inside the mine, like eating and things that might happen. But there were so few miners there then. There was, I would say maybe there was about 6 working miners at the end, actually working in the coal, you know. The rest of them were running motors or something like that, you know. But there wasn't that much activity and all that, but it didn't change anything, no.
I'm going to backtrack a little bit here. We'll probably end on this question because I want to tie you up. And you've been very, very civil, and I thank you for giving us, sharing your memories with me. Could you explain for posterity what Lance Coal was and how it evolved? To the best of your knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, after the coal company closed in 1960...
This was Pierce who was running it? Coaldale Mining then?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Uh-huh. And there was a number of miners who worked at Number 9. Who decided one day that they had nothing to do. I mean, they had no jobs and all that. So they approached the coal company. It was Fazio's then at the time, I think. And I think they approached them if they could open up Number 9 and ship all their coal, you know, deep mine coal to the breaker. They actually paid for it. And It was headed by Johnny Zuzu, who's lived down the street here, and Stevie Carabinos, who was a clerk. He did all the kind of the paperwork mm-hmm. for the thing, and Stevie Zaliha from Coaldale, and Muggy Oriole from up the street here. The four of them decide they're going to open this mine up, and they spend a number of months and all that outfitting the tracks again and doing some timber work in the gangway and all that. And then they hired some workers, and I don't know exactly how long it was, but Jackie Yelch has a real good description of the number 9 in that booklet, you know, from Scranton. He's a very good description of the booklet,
right,
of the mine, of how it evolved. And Jack was a little more student of dates and all that than I was. I was always more interested in the pictures and all that.
That's all I want to know, the impressions, is your impression.
And I think they worked at the mine about 10 or 12 years. They made a living, not much. Someone said they were making $20 a day, which was not much, I guess. But to them, it was great. Stanley Stanek had a job up in Stroudsburg, and he gave it up to come back work here. He said, best job he ever had. He said, I don't have to drive to Stroudsburg. I just run down from some of the hill down here, and I'm at work, you know. And they were a great group of guys, though. I mean,
it was a camaraderie.
Right, yeah. They talked about each other and cursed each other and all that, but I think if they ever had to go to bat for each other, they would too, you know. And it was to be part of that. Part of that group was. I guess the great climax to this thing, all, you know, started.
So it must be an issue like a brotherhood or something.
Yeah, but and if it was going to end, it was a good way it ended like this, you know.
No bitterness, no controversy.
No. And then, as you know, they continued, you know, to get together as we do each year, and they still accepted me as one of them, you know, and. Which was, I was glad, because many times people would ask me and say, well, you know, coal miners, who wants to take pictures of coal miners and all that? I mean, with their dirty faces and all that and things like that. He said, did any of them ever object to you? I said, no, not that I remember, not that I could recall. I said, I don't think any of them ever objected me to taking their pictures. In fact, a lot of them not insisted, but, you know, they would... gave me the impression that they would like their picture taken on it. And coal mining had taken on a different aspect. Once it started to become part of the passing scene and all that, miners, they weren't ashamed of being called coal miners. Years mm-hmm. back, if someone left here maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago, left, where did you come from? You never mentioned you came from the coal regions, or your father was a coal miner. You kind of thought it was a kind of a degrading type of a job, maybe it was in those days, you know, to put on dirty old clothes and climb into a hole in the ground and then dig out some coal and put it on a car and then have it in then have nothing more to look forward to at the end of the day is probably a shot in a beer or something like that, and go to bed and do the same thing the next day, you know. And it wasn't, but later on, the latter-day miners were proud of it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were proud of it. They figured, yeah, I'm a coal miner. I was a coal miner. And I think it changed. I think now, the good evidence is a lot of them on their tombstones are already inscribed on it, I was a coal miner or something, you know. So it's changed.
It becomes from the commonplace to the special, I think.
Well, people realized at first, you know, people never realized how dangerous and a dirty type of a job it was and all that. and you were looked down at. I mean, if you were a boss, fine. If you worked in the office, you'd fine. But if you were a coal miner, you were, who cared, you know? I mean, except in your immediate family, no one cared. And later on through the years, they attained a certain type of dignity or something like that, that now I think they're proud of it. I think they're proud of it, that they worked in a coal mine.
And I think that you're lucky you're able to record it, because you were part of the process.
I was fortunate that I was given the opportunity, sure, because what made me do it and stay with it, you know, I could have taken a few years and then quit and all that, and could have got out of photography, really. But it was something that I couldn't do. I mean, it was... I think if there was still a mine down there now, I'd probably be down there yesterday or something.
It's your life's work. That's how I feel about the museum. It's something you've got to do. Mm-hmm. For the records, what actually caused Lance Cole to close?
Oh, I think it was the state. The state was kind of insisting that they put a fan house up. They had plenty of ventilation because they were only working at the water level. They weren't going down, really. They were just going into the mountain. And the state was insisting that they put a fan house and get a little more ventilation, which they didn't really need. And it was too expensive for them. And they didn't have the finances to really install this fan. So they just closed it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think that's basically what happened.
On that note, George, we're going to end today's session.
Okay.
I want to thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
And this has been great. I've learned an awful lot. Thank you. Mm-hmm.